Watching Beyond the Headlines with Mike Matthews.
We're back. Hank, we were discussing this article from Becker's Hospital that said that 40% of hospital employees are taking their PPE off incorrectly. Of those 40%, 10% had contaminated scrubs underneath, and that was contaminated with stuff like MRSA. And let me take this time to introduce our special guest, a good friend of the show, Mr. Sean Flynn. Sean, please introduce yourself.
Hello, guys. I'm pleasure. You know, I'm actually attending the CCFA conference on Saturday and actually speaking. So it's welcome to, you know, appreciate the invite and, you know, perfect timing. Lots of people coming out to Vegas and going to talk about a lot of similar topics. And, you know, it's always encouraging to see professionals come out on their weekend. Not to mention it's Vegas, but, you know, that always encourages people to come out. But good stuff. And I appreciate the invite.
So, Sean, let me get your quick read on this. Hank and I were discussing, you know, among many things, the problems with particularly not having facility-issued scrubs or wearing the same pair of scrubs between multiple facilities. I was actually, before our feed cut off, talking about a facility that I was associated with a long time ago that actually had their scrubs stamped. With, you know, this is the property of this particular hospital, but you would see those scrubs in just about every hospital in the area. And apparently that was considered, you know, like normal behavior for reps in particular who travel a lot between multiple hospitals to be wearing these scrubs from one OR to the outside to in their car back to another hospital and into a totally different OR. You know, this is what. Those things that it's purely there. It's like you shouldn't even really have to make a policy about it because it's just common sense, but apparently it's not that common. What's your quick read on something like this?
No, it's probably more pervasive than actually what's put out in the media, to be honest with you. It's bad behavior, and unfortunately, you know, people are putting themselves at risk, particularly just take something as simple as shoe attire. They'll bring shoes from the outside, bring them in, and go throughout the course of their day, may or may not wear shoe covers, and then they take those same shoes back home. And I don't know if it's a combination of lack of education or just thinking that you have this superiority complex that nothing's going to bother you or affect you, but, you know, it's a problem, and it's pretty big. I see physicians, I see them having masks that are hanging down. They'll go eat lunch, they'll come back to the OR, use the same mask. I see nurses who do the same thing. And I'm like, okay, if, you know, we're to adhere to a certain particular standard, and if I look at the hierarchy of the institution, if anybody should be adhering to those policies 100% accuracy, it should be the physicians and the nurses. It starts with the leadership, right? Not to pick on them, but then what ends up happening is it becomes pervasive throughout the institution, and everybody feels like they can get away with it. You know, you go to any cafeteria in the hospital and you'll see it.
Yeah. You bring up a really good point because we've talked about many times that, you know, knowing our industry, knowing that we typically, those of us who are in this industry, we didn't go to school for this. And so we look to our clinical leaders like doctors, like nurses who did go, you know, to 4+ years of that education. And when we see them say, oh, it's no big deal, I mean, it's almost natural to say, well, if it's not a big deal to them, it must not be a big deal for me. Very often the excuse that you'll hear, and this is one that drives me absolutely up the wall, is, listen, I've been doing this for 20 years and nothing's ever happened. It only takes one. I mean, how many times in your life are you planning to be infected with MRSA?
Exactly. And that, you know, I think we've gone to multiple conferences, and one of my friends who she talks about this all the time, she, you know, people work in decontamination, right? And they're not wearing proper PPE, and they're seeing hundreds of thousands of instruments come through with varying degrees of bioburden on them. And she sort of commented, do you really want to take something home or have something funny growing on your face, you know, or on your body, or, you know, and and it's really, it exactly is what it says. It's your personal protective equipment. And I couldn't imagine in any other industry, for that matter, negating the various safety protocols, right? Having the opportunity to work in the biotech and tissue banking industry, I can tell you that for particulates, if you're talking about, air handling and particulates in the air, those things are critical. And if you don't do certain things, that the recipient of that donated tissue will actually, get certain pathogens. And those are life-enhancing surgeries in most cases. But you take it a step further, and inside the institution, we're not even adhering to our own policies and procedures. That's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. You bring up a good example from other industries. I immediately thought about clean room protocols and technology. For example, if you're working with microprocessors, you wear a full body bunny suit anytime you're in the clean room. And I don't think anybody kind of looks at that and says, well, it's really hot, so I don't really feel like wearing that. Like, no, that's not an option. You don't get to choose. That is required. Yeah. And so you're going to do it.
Yeah, and your evaluation is actually based on that, right? So it's part of your performance. It's part of, the quality of the work that you do. And I just think people have gotten pretty lackadaisy to, just distill it down and really thinking that nothing will happen to them, right?
Yeah.
They don't actually see, particularly your non-end users or the people that actually touch the patient, they don't actually see the implications of it. And so being far removed from that patient experience, then they say, oh, well, it'll never happen to me, right? When in fact, they're exposing themselves daily to a number of pathogens that they don't know about. And fortunately for them, the viral load has never gotten to the point where it actually affects them. But it could happen in one day, right?
Yep.
And it's sad to see, but this is where, and you alluded to this, this is where leadership comes in, because I've even seen on the, let's just say, medical director board or on that level, if you just take a look at the controversy between bouffants and headgear, male headgear, right?
Yeah.
There was so much discussion about that related to wear bouffant, not wear bouffant, male-female dynamics associated with that. And I'm reading all these articles about it. I'm like, are we really putting that much energy associated with that when we have so many other things that are in our environment that contribute to SSIs and HAIs? I don't understand the focus of that in comparison to all the other issues that we have to deal with. Pedicle screws, for example, they go from one hospital to the next. They're never hardly inspected. I can't tell you the quality control that happens in one hospital from the next. But yet that same pedicle screw set is going to be implanted into a patient. And, nobody's looking at biofilm. Nobody's looking at the bioburden that's actually on those instruments. I don't know if anybody, correct me if I'm wrong, Hank or Matt, do anybody take out the pedicle screws and actually individually inspect them from the screw caddy?
No, not unless you drop them on the floor.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, and then, think about it. All these loaner trays that are going out, nobody's looking at that stuff. And astonishing.
And in fact, at many facilities, and this is not a practice that is promoted, but it is something that happens. If you know that a loaner tray is not coming back into your OR, it takes a modified workflow out of Deacon Tam, right?
So absolutely, it does.
If there's a tray that's going to get some of the steps that are skipped, it's going to be the tray that we know, oh yeah, that's going across town, or it's going somewhere else. It's not in our OR. And so that just gets a quick clean or a quick wash. And that's even leading more and more to what you're saying is, hey, you can't trust the quality standards of another facility that you're not aware of who they are, what they do, what their own internal standards are. And yet we let that thing into our facility. And as you said, we're not currently standardized across the industry to inspect each one of those screws. It's almost impossible.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I wanted to go back to something that you had mentioned. about, you know, the chain of infection and how it spreads from lax, you know, practices within the sterile processing area all the way to the end user. And sometimes that's lost on the frontline technician, because you don't ever see that patient. You don't see them when they're dealing with an infection a week later. You don't see them when they're a bring back case, you know, 3 days later. You don't see that stuff. So it's kind of lost. But I think that when we discuss things like that, it goes back to the culture of the overall environment. And the truth is that if you don't respect how dangerous and insidious a bacteria like MRSA can be with your own personal health, I find it very difficult to believe that you're going to take it serious that that same bacteria can make it to a person that you're never going to see. You know, It speaks to the respect that we have on our end about how pervasive bacteria viruses can be when we don't even bother to protect ourselves.
Correct. No, you're absolutely right. I mean, and think about sterile processing in the sense of either a hub for sterility insurance, or conversely, it could be a hub for mass infection. And we've seen those things happen in the media, where, you know, hospitals and or surgery centers or dental practices get into the news and they have a mass breakdown in sterility assurance. And if you do the simple math, if you think, well, if you're just in a hospital, mid-level hospital, average 6.1 trays per case, you're doing, let's say, 35,000 cases a year, and on average, each one of those sets have roughly 100 instruments in it, you're talking about millions of instruments that flow through that sterile process and that impact all 35,000 of those patients. And if your quality isn't tight enough in that sterile processing department, you're going to have an issue on a scale that you can't even consider. Yeah. Right? And people work in sterile processing know this, and this is where I get so frustrated with the disconnect between administration and sterile processing, is that they don't understand the scale of what could happen, right? And I'm not saying spend a ton of money trying to mitigate what's not currently happened, but if you don't invest in that department, what will end up happening is that pervasive culture or negative culture is going to contribute to something that you can't anticipate. And when it happens, now you got a bigger issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to switch gears. We're going to move on to the next topic. Go ahead.
Hey, so before you do that, I want to throw out this question, you know, to two of the leading subject matter experts in the country.
Who's the other one?
No. Appreciate that. Right. But, you know, we're a collective group.
There you go. I'm gonna put y'all on the spot though for this one, and it's more of a. This is going back to something that the article mentioned and that Mike referenced, the idea of standard precautions, right? And yet, even though we teach that and we preach that in sterile processing, the reality is in many departments, you'll get a case cart that comes downstairs with a sign on it that says Hep B, or mm-hmm. that says MRSA, or that says HIV. And so there's that additional, you know, signaling. And I've seen those carts, and I've been back in Decontam when I get them, and if I'm honest, you know, with everybody, I treated those things differently because it was just in your face. You know, like there's one thing that, I took this training module, you know, 6 months ago. It talked about standard precautions that we're going to treat everything as if it's as contagious as possible. But then there's another thing to know. These instruments are X, Y, and Z. So my question for y'all is, what do you think about that practice of tagging those case carts? I think I could probably guess what you think, but I just kind of want to hear each of y'all give your answer on that. And then, you know, based on your answer, how do we use that to impact how we train our staff or how we keep that in the forefront of their mind? So I'll throw it to you first, Sean, and then Mike, if you want to follow up for him.
Cool.
Well, I always appreciate the courtesy, but I actually frown upon signs like that because I want people treating every set as if it was contaminated with the worst thing that they can possibly think of. And with that mentality, what they'll end up doing is treating every set like they should. One, they'll protect themselves, but then two, they'll go out of their way to make sure that that set is bioburden free and defect free moving forward for the next patient. I get the human factor where people want to look out for each other, and I appreciate that, but we all should be adherent to universal precautions and not have to worry about actually applying any signs or anything like that. Because conversely, you get into, well, what was the patient? And a lot of times we'll get case cards back. We'll still have the patient information. And I really don't want the team, you know, delving into that aspect either. Now you know the patient has hepatitis and there's a name associated with it and the conversation ensues. And, you know, so there's other implications, but long answer short, I don't like those signs at all.
Yeah, so I'm basically just going to echo the same thing Sean said. I had this situation happen when I first took over for my first management job. We had a patient come in who had a really nasty case of necrotizing fasciitis, flesh-eating bacteria, and the scrub techs had left a note on the case card that was used for that patient saying, you know, hey, this patient had, you know, flesh-eating bacteria, be careful. And I went to the scrub techs and I told them, I said, listen, I really appreciate you, thinking about our people, because I do like the fact that you felt the need to notify that you understand that there is a person in there in Decontam, not just a decontamination robot. So I appreciate you thinking of that, but we're going to treat everything as though it has necrotizing fasciitis. I mean, we treat everything the same way. And so it almost becomes like an opportunity for you to explain your standards to the OR that you treat everything as though it is contaminated with the worst of the worst. And it almost becomes a way to promote yourselves within that culture.
Correct.
Yeah. So, Mike, I do want to follow up. We got a comment on our Facebook feed here from Ray.
Yep.
And I don't know if Ray follows us consistently or not, or if he's being a little tongue-in-cheek, you know. But he said that y'all are talking about scrubs, but how about we talk about all the weak budgets for sterile processing?
Ooh.
The weak salary for techs, the weak joint commission surveys, the weak Department of Health surveys, infection control, zero knowledge of SPD, putting our patients under surgery without instrumentation ready and available. And so I just had to, comment and say, Ray, you're talking to the right crew for that. So how about, we spent a couple of minutes just kind of speaking to some of those. I know many times through the podcast, we have talked about salary issues and compensation issues and budgets. In addition, to joint commission survey topics, all the way down to collaborating with infection control. You know, Mike, that was the first interview that we ever did on the podcast, was how to collaborate and why it's important. But I'll let you go first, Mike. You know, any of those topics really stir your passion that you want to comment on?
Well, Hank's softballing them in there to me. I think it was Ray. If you haven't listened to our podcast, if you haven't been reading our articles, listen, we talk about all of those things. And you're absolutely right. There is a problem with a number of things, including compensation, including budgets. But I do want to emphasize that the solution for us as an industry is not any one of those things. It's a combination of all of them. Yes, there is a compensation problem. You will never hear us back down from that. There is a problem with people in our profession not getting paid enough money. However, if we just pay people more money, does that solve the problems in our industry? Absolutely not. There are a multiplicity of problems, and we see that even emphasized within this same article, you know, that we've seen multiple times, like we just talked about, people not taking PPE seriously. And guess what? Mm-hmm. Nurses don't take it seriously sometimes. Doctors don't take it seriously sometimes. Reps don't take it seriously sometimes. They all get paid a lot more money, and it has nothing, it has no impact on the fact that they don't take their PPE seriously. And so this is an education and culture issue as much as it is a compensation issue. So I want to be very clear to say that this is why we talk about all of those things on this show, is because we believe that there is no one silver bullet answer. We have to collaborate together. We have to talk about multiple things. And this is one of the reasons we love talking to Sean so much, is because Sean, you just heard him run through some numbers, making a numbers argument, because that's the kind of things that we, that's the way that we have to be thinking about things when we go to bat with administration to talk about stuff like budgets. You know, we have to be able to make those numbers arguments. That's enough for my soapbox, because I will seriously talk for the next 30 minutes straight.
I think the viewers basically preaching to the choir. I mean, we collectively with the three of us, you know, I'll always go to bat for being a technician being adequately paid, right? But I also know that we're competing with a level of bureaucracy that has a hierarchical system within the healthcare institution, right? And if you look at sterile processing and where they're at, even their physical location in the hospital, they're treated accordingly, and it's sad, right? So after, you know, 28 plus years and having, you know, experience related to sterile processing, whether it be in biotech industry and or in hospitals, whether it's surgical tech or in sterile processing running department, I'm to the point now, Hank, and I'll probably, you know, say something very controversial. Sterile processing needs to come out of the hospital and needs to be privatized, because you're competing with so many different factors related to budget and resources that it's a no-win battle. And so when you're faced with these situations where whatever hospital you're in, it's like, I got to pay for this new OR. I got to pay for this. I got to pay for that. And then when you look at sterile processing, it's like a non sequitur. You just, hey, okay, that's an afterthought, right? And I think the only way that you can legitimize it to the point where it is, and I'll argue that this is a, in fact, service that is a revenue generating service, and a necessity for the hospital, you got to take it out of the hospital. And their case in point, Erlanger just did a deal with Steris for $9 million a year for 15 years to run an offsite facility for a 740-something bed hospital system. And you tell me that sterile processing isn't revenue generating and isn't important. It's important enough for them to spend $9 million a year. Hmm. So I honestly, you know, in all these years, I fought those battles with administration, and I've won some and I've lost some. But I don't think you can realize the level of importance and or pay people commensurate with what they're worth and standardize the industry unless you pull it out of the hospital.
Wow. Yeah. So you kind of threw that fireball out here. And I don't know, you know, Mike, do we want to spend some time talking about that?
Sure. Okay. I mean, why not? This is a free flowing show.
All right. So... to clarify for the audience, you know, if you heard what Sean said, he's arguing that to solve many of these problems, and again, you know, no one here is saying that there is one silver bullet that's going to solve all the problems overnight, but the idea that if we can remove this service out from underneath the hospital umbrella per se, not only off-site, but also in a private, I guess you'd say private ownership, right? So third party processing going on here, that then you would free yourselves from a lot of the capital constraints, the staffing constraints, the workflow and volume constraints. to then set your own quality standards, similar to what y'all talking earlier with the clean room, you know, like, why can't we do that? Well, because what hospital today is going to decide of their own accord that I'm going to set my sterile processing up to clean room standards? But for a private company, you could totally decide that. It's your company. It's your process. Yeah. If you want to set that standard up and make that the gold standard in the industry, well, there you go. I think
not to interrupt you. But let's put this in perspective. We have hospitals now who are processing scopes at a rate of, I mean, just, I'll look at my own facility. We do 500 scopes a month, right? And if I look at the landscape in aggregate, U.S. hospitals, 5,000 surgery centers, or 5,000 hospitals, 6,000 surgery centers, whatever. Tell me what the percentage is of ownership of fluoroscope technology within those hospitals and surgery centers.
Yeah.
Probably less than 1%.
Too dang low.
Too low, and it's directly tied to we don't have the budget for it. Now, you tell me, how can I clean something that I can't see, right? And you tell me that then I don't have the budget for it. Really? So when we're looking at this, and I've been looking at it from the standpoint of, okay, how do you really revolutionize this industry, right? You look at the auto industry. When they went and reformed the auto industry and made it more cutting edge, they didn't retrofit their existing factory. They actually built new factories. And so they then, out of those new factories, they were able to achieve a higher sense of efficiencies and or productivity, right? What we have is a situation within healthcare where we're trying to plug the hole with a broken system, right? If I can't get a borescope with all the other challenges that sterile processing faces, we got an issue. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if people are paying out of pocket for stuff, but if I'm responsible for cleaning something that's going to be used on another patient, I would want to see what I've done to make sure that there was no issue with that next patient. And literally, we have administrators who say, "Oh, we don't have the budget." Really? That is shocking to me. And so I'm now to the point where I'm just focused on how can we totally revolutionize this industry, pull it out of the hospital to where we're paid we're paid commensurate with the level of service, and that we up the quality tenfold, decrease the operating cost of sterile processing, and deliver a service that is commensurate with what every individual that I know in sterile processing wants to achieve. And that's making sure that every patient is safe and that they have safe medical devices that can be used on them.
I mean, I think you bring up a really great point, and that is most facilities, the vast majority of facilities, cannot tell you what their cost is for reprocessing a single instrument. So therefore, they don't know what it costs. They don't know what the cost is of not doing it right. They don't know what the cost is of your high employee turnover rate. They don't know what the cost of poor quality is. Now, if we were using Lean Six Sigma terms, that would be our big key, is our COPQ, cost of poor quality. And the vast majority, I mean, I'm not saying vast majority, I'm talking like 95% of hospitals have no clue what they're actually spending. We've talked about this before on the show, how there's this impression that once you build a sterile processing department, it's like this magical box. And like, it doesn't matter how much you throw at it, everything that gets spit out on the other side is free and it's sterile. So, I mean, I got to give, I just pulled up the article that you referenced where Erlanger announced their contract with Steris. And actually, I have to give Erlanger a lot of credit because it says that they have been adding ORs, and the last time that their sterile processing department was updated was 1993. And I'm seeing that and saying 1993 really wasn't that bad. I've seen a lot of facilities that haven't been updated since the 70s. So I got to give them a lot of credit that this is very forward thinking on their part. But you make a good point that apparently somebody has done the math. They've looked at what is it costing them to do it themselves? And then is it possible, is it more cost effective to take it somewhere else? And another key piece that a lot of people don't think about, including hospital administration, is what's the space worth? Space in a hospital is at a premium. And so when your ORs, those have to be in the hospital, right? And they're revenue generating space. But your sterile processing department, on the other hand, if it can be done somewhere else where that space doesn't cost quite so much money, it might actually make sense to make sure your revenue generators are on site and your cost facilities are off site. So, it's very forward thinking, but it's out there.
Yeah, no, and I think cost wise, like, roughly, I give you a swag. It's 71 cents per instrument, right? And that's including the consumables, the electricity, the labor, all the other nuances associated with reprocessing an instrument, right? But what tended to happen historically was that the ORs were upgraded. The ORs were added on. So you went from 25 to 30 to 40 ORs, and your sterile processing space then was not upgraded. And then on top of that, in the last 10, 15 years, what ended up happening is hospitals bought all these surgery centers. So now all the surgery centers have reprocessing needs, and those needs are then funneled through sterile processing with no upgrades, hardly any upgrades of an equipment, upgrades of staffing, salary, all those things that contribute toward poor quality. And it's at a tipping point now where your front-leaning hospitals understand that. They're like, we can no longer sustain this. But all the issues that you're seeing in the news with many other hospitals, those are symptoms of neglect of the engine that runs their quote-unquote revenue generating. And I will argue that ORs do not generate revenue. ORs provide a service. If anybody that generates revenue, it's the clinic and or the schedulers or the physicians, for that matter, who actually triage the patients to then send them for their prospective treatment. And I'll go down a rabbit hole with the old revenue generating thing. That could be another topic. But, you don't buy a luxury car and don't get the engine oil changed, right? That's how I see sterile processing in the OR, right? You got these hybrid rooms and all these high technical medical devices that need to be reprocessed, but you don't have the equipment to reprocess. That was a bad investment, if you ask in my opinion.
Hey, so let me throw this out here because we got another comment from Ray. And he said, outsourcing to offsite actually drops the pay for SPD techs, right? So even before he commented that, I'm thinking as I'm listening to this, and it's common sense, and I know y'all agree with it, but just outsourcing it or off-siting it to a third party doesn't automatically make it better, right? Like, if you're doing the same if it's the same crappy workflow, the same poor quality, the same lack of staffing and training and compensation that you're doing in the basement 3 miles away in a factory, then you're going to get the same results, hate to tell you.
Correct.
So it is a concept of, yes, it's a location change, but it's more than just a location change. It's a cultural change, and it's a philosophical change, right? Like, we're going to do this differently. We're going to do it better. We're going to do it in a disruptive fashion. So it's important.
You're 100%, raised 100%. But in order to take that first step to, let's just say, standardization, right? The reason why we can't standardize the sterile process, and look at all the GPO agreements around the country, and every hospital has a different GPO agreement, right? That then dictates what supplies you order, right? If me and you go down the street and we look at a stop sign, everybody knows what a stop sign is. But if I go to five different sterile processing departments, I may have five different indicators that tell me what sterility is or isn't, right? Why is that? These all should be standardized to the point where we have visual indicators that tell us exactly what's sterile, what's not sterile. Part of the confusion in the industry is if you're by trying to reduce the error associated with human factoring, is it's not standard. We have standards, don't get me wrong, but those standards then leave room for interpretation, and then when they're embedded into a bureaucracy and a facility and a GPO agreement and then so on and so forth, what you get is non-standardized practices.
Speaking of non-standardized practices, you know, one of, I don't know, this is probably 7 years ago or so, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, I wrote an article talking about pay for performance. And again, you know, this is going back into what you're talking about in the upside to privatizing is I was so frustrated as a sterile processing manager to see some of my technicians just killing it. I mean, they're there, they are mass producers, like they're carrying the rest of the department. So yeah, you know, 25% of my employees are producing 50, 60, 70% of the total.
The 80-20 rule.
Correct. And I could not reward them. Like I could maybe eventually, if there was a spot, I could possibly promote them. I can give them a pat on the back and a pizza party, but I can't even just do it for them. I got to do it for everybody, right? But in the private world, you can get a bonus. If you kill it, you get a bonus. If you kill it, like you get compensated and incentivized to keep killing it. And there's no reason in a privatized setting that we could not do a similar compensation model for sterile processing technicians that are great at their job. We're not talking about, you know, going so quickly that you're cutting quarters or anything else, but there are folks who know the job, who understand the instruments, who can follow all the compliant procedures and still produce twice as much as someone who's, you know, I don't know, 5 years behind them, like whatever it is. But those folks should be compensated, incentivized, and you can't do it in today's model in a hospital setting. There's no freaking way. Like you can hardly even give a raise unless everybody gets a raise, much less any kind of bonus model.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, and Hank, I can tell you from an entrepreneur's perspective, if you reduce operational costs, right, and you can do that a number of ways, why not pass that to the technicians who actually are enabling you to reduce operational costs? And I don't think you can do that inside the hospital. I just don't. So to Ray's point, yes, he's absolutely correct. Now that's commensurate with the companies and the company's culture. But moving forward, I do think there'll be competition in the sense that the company culture will then dictate the best and the brightest working for a specific company. And if they're well compensated, well trained, and understand what their value is, I do believe they'll be competitive and they'll be rewarded. And you can do that on a private setting versus being up under a hospital.
Well, hopefully somebody out there has heard this and has said, you know what, I'm going to start the next sterile processing business. You know, you can partner with us. We're happy to help. I think that this is probably the future. This is probably where we need to go. It's probably a bit forward thinking for a lot of facilities, but this is the type of thing that would catch on virally. I think that if once you prove the cost, the quality improvements, once you prove, and I think it would be very reasonable to be able to prove the savings from improved patient outcomes, tracking these types of things, it would then become a competitive advantage for one group over another group, whereas now things like surgical site infection rates are shameful and hospitals hide them, which is one of the reasons we have such a serious lack of data regarding what a sterile processing person actually contributes to the patient outcome. There's a reason why we don't have that data. It's because hospitals hide it when they have it, and because they're afraid of being sued. Whereas if you had an outsourced facility, you know, that would be something that would be one of your sales pitches. Like, listen, the facilities that use this saw a 2% drop in their surgical site infection rates. Man, hospitals be throwing money at you like that. You know, so I think there's a lot of opportunity out there for this. And like I said, it's a little forward for most places, but the groups that do buy in, I think there's going to be some serious, serious benefit there. It looks like Erlanger, for example, is probably on the cutting edge of that. We're at 52 minutes of our 1 hour show, and we've talked about one of three topics. So,
well, hey, Mike, I just want to add this to what you just said.
Yeah.
The other caveat to that is the underreporting of medical devices that have malfunctioned, and that if consolidated and centralized, you would have a better reporting structure,
yes.
Right? Both from the manufacturer as well as from the reprocessing effort, right? If you increase the inspection capabilities and then understand the functionality of these medical devices, you'll be able to then train your team to how to report these events. I can't tell you how many folks in the hospital who don't even understand what a MOD report is. And I've said this before on a podcast, but it shocks me. So that is the information that the FDA then looks at to then make a determination on how to act as far as a malfunction device or what to do with a prospective company who produces that medical device. So it's twofold, right? Hospital, and then you got the whole medical device thing. They're way more complicated now. Look at the scopes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well,
yep, absolutely.
And I wanted to throw out too, in the U.S., this offsite reprocessing is still a fairly new and foreign idea, even though there are a handful currently operational in the U.S., but in Europe especially, mm-hmm. they're all over the place. It's
correct.
It's not an unknown entity. It is very well established in the processes. I'm not saying that they don't have challenges, obviously, because there's even been news reports out there, you know, for those kinds of things. But that doesn't mean that the concept can't be improved. But it's been shown that it works and that there is an impact, that it's possible. And so the foundation is already laid by our European counterparts to say, hey, especially in these highly populated areas with multiple facilities within just mere miles of each other, if not less than that, right? That there's all kinds of real opportunity to provide high quality at a low cost. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we're just not able to do within the hospital setting, as you mentioned.
Hey, Hank, great point. Tell Ray to keep doing what he's doing because he's asking the right questions.
All right, I'll do that.
Yep, absolutely. All right, gentlemen, we want to go to the next topic.
I got all night, Mike. I got no plans. I'm bored.
All right, so let's go. Well, I mean, this actually is really well connected to what we were just talking about. We were discussing budgeting needs and when it comes to getting the equipment that you need to process various instrument types. Our own Hank Balch created just a little infographic that just gives a little, you know, explanation. Listen, if you've got this instrument, you need this testing device. And it's actually gotten a lot of traction. It has been shared a number of times just on Facebook. It's going all over the place because I think it's hitting a high note for a lot of people being the fact that oftentimes instruments are purchased by the OR with zero consideration given to what is necessary to actually reprocess those devices. And I'll just give a little anecdote from one of back when I was very new in management. We had a flexible, difficult intubation scope that had been purchased by a ambulatory surgery center. And I had no idea that this thing even existed, number one. But number two, when it actually came to me, started looking at it and said, you know what, I don't know that I've got an IFU for this. I don't know anything about this. So I looked it up. It turns out that the only validated form of sterilization for this thing was ethylene oxide. And so I go to the OR director, I go to the anesthesiologist, who's the head anesthesiologist, and I said, you know, hey, I don't know who bought this thing, but you forgot to ask for how to reprocess it because we don't have what it is required. I legally cannot reprocess this. And the anesthesiologist looked at me and said, well, can you just get like a can of ethylene oxide and like spray it or something? I said, no, that's not the way it works. I'm sorry. And she said, well, I guess you would know better than I do. And so, like, this happens all the time that, you know, when purchasing decisions are made, it's usually like, you know, this really slick rep talking to OR leadership or supply chain or administration, none of whom has probably set foot in SPD. And that is just something that literally no one even thinks about. And so I think this is hitting a nerve.
Yeah. No, I can tell you, even at the facility that I'm at now, you know, they've made purchases and, you know, we've had to consult. And luckily, you know, there's a group of us that come together when decisions are made like that. And there's been occasions where, you know, we would, SPD would be the one, the voice in the room that basically says, you cannot process this unless we get this piece of equipment. And it was a new insight into that meeting. And I applaud the hospital for having a cross collaborative, you know, form like that, because a lot of places just don't. Physicians will want certain things and they need certain things to do their procedures. So don't get me wrong. I'm not the one who says, you know, don't buy something for patient care because we can't process it. I am the proponent of saying, please buy that, but then give us the tools necessary to do what we need to do to reprocess so it's safe for the next patient.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just part of the cost of ownership. You know, you use one of my favorite examples. You know, when you buy a new car, you don't throw a fit when the mechanic says, hey, by the way, you're going to have to change the oil occasionally. You just understand that's part of the cost of ownership. You know, the one-time purchase price is not the only cost. Mm-hmm. We understand that in a lot of different industries. The just seems like one that just seems to slip by is the reprocessing industry.
Yeah, well, and it goes back to what you said earlier, Mike, and you know, I don't want to talk down to folks in administration or in the OR, but there is that assumption of the magic box in sterile processing that, yeah, whatever we buy, if we throw it in the magic box of sterile processing, it's going to come out sterile and high-level disinfected. Like, it's going to come out the way that it should, regardless of if they have the right tools or if they have the right inspection equipment, for instance. But if we're sharing examples, I'll give you another very real example that I see in hospitals all over the country. Is on my consulting trips, I'll go down to the decontamination room and they'll have two or three robots up in the OR. They're very proud of those robots. They're on a big billboard outside the hospital. And then you go out into the decontamination area. There's not one sink in the entire hospital that is long enough to manually soak all those robotic arms. There's not one ultrasonic cleaner that's equipped with the accessories to adequately flush those robotic arms. I mean, it's a disaster. There's a lot of workarounds. There's temporary sinks. There's tubs that they buy. But it just goes back again to $1 million capital investment in a robotic console. No one stopped to ask the question, can we even soak these things, much less, you know, sonicate, wash them? And it's a real shame, you know, but it's something like we just can't sit here and complain. Not that that's what we're doing, but it's something that we need to educate and empower sterile process. And like you said, Sean, get in those meetings, find a way to be at those purchasing meetings, at the initial sales pitch. Like, if you see a rep in there with your OR director, find out what it is he's pitching and make sure that your OR director knows, hey, we need to ask these questions about that device before we make any purchase.
That's been a really common theme that we've talked about multiple times on the show, both this show and throughout the podcast, is the need for cross collaboration. You know, if you are trying to, you know, be the solo voice in there, if you're hiding in your office, if you're a sterile processing manager and you aren't spending a lot of time in the OR talking to the end users, making friends with the OR director, you know, you're just cutting your own throat. You need to be at the table You need to bring things like this up, you know, and if you're just hiding in your office, I mean, you're just doing yourself a disservice.
Here's the thing, Mike. So two things. So Hank, the administrator doesn't know what they don't know, right? And I'm sure many people who are listening on this have heard that phrase before. You don't know what you don't know. And so as a subject matter expert, and this is to Mike's point, is you have to be bold, go into those meetings, know what you know, and you sell what you need, okay? They don't know what they don't know. And that includes the OR, that includes their the administrators, that includes whomever your customer is. They don't know what you know. And you have to make the case. And this goes back to the hierarchical system in the OR, right? It's almost like a caste system. And you have to break free of that and then have the internal confidence as a leader in that department to then go out into the world, into that OR, into that hospital administrator, and say, this is what I need to do the job, and this is the outcome. Alternatively, if I don't get this, this is what's going to happen. And so you need to basically make your case so that they understand that you need what you need. And too often what I find is when I go, and to your point, Hank, when you go and consult, sterile processing departments have been beat down so much because everything is focused on the 1 to 2 to 3% of errors and never the 98% of the things that they do well. And so they have a fear of going out into these departments and actually selling and making their case and say, this is how I contribute to the organization. I can't tell you, we talked about earlier in the numbers associated with it. If there's any one department that can actually have a detrimental effect on the institution, it's sterile processing, but yet it lacks the investment commensurate with its ability to mess up the reputation of the health system.
Yeah, and we've seen that. We've seen that multiple times. We've talked about that on the show, numbers of facilities that it gets cited, and anytime they get cited, it's big public news. Mm-hmm. You know, and Sean, you bring up a really good point about, you know, the sterile processing, the, usually the manager or the director, the leader, whoever it is, having to be the one who goes and sells the device internally. And this is kind of, speaking to two groups here, not just the managers, but also the reps for the companies who sell these various devices that you need, whether it be the insulation testing device, the sinks, the borescopes, the microscopes. Listen, I'm going to just give you a sales tip right now that you will take the time to equip the manager, that manager is the one who's going to go and then sell that product internally. So you are doing yourself a serious disservice if you are not actively seeking to equip that manager with the tools, the education, the knowledge necessary, then go and sell that internally to their administration. You know, this is, you need to partner with them, and that's gonna be what sells your product right there. Partner with them, give them the education, give them the tools, the training they need to go make that pitch.
Yeah. Well, I want to jump in here on the borescope because you use it as an example there, Mike, and then Sean, you mentioned it earlier, but I know for Mike and I don't know about you, Sean, you know, but neither one of us have any stock in borescopes, right? So we're not, not like we're advocating for borescopes because we get paid for it, but I do want to encourage everyone, you know, who's listening now and who watches this video afterwards, that that's one of those devices that is not a nice to have a device. That is a must have device. Many IFUs even today are stating it, you know, but to your earlier point, Sean, if you can't see it, if there's any device in your facility that you cannot see inside of to verify not only cleanliness, but is it rusty inside? Is it cracked? Is it chipped? You know, who knows? Are there brush,
Brush mark, yes.
Yeah, like are there bristles? Like, who knows?
Yep.
And so I really want you to walk away from this video. There's nothing else besides all the laughs that you've had. But I want you to walk away saying, okay, I'm going back to my SPD, and I'm going to draw the red line and say, guys, it is unsafe what we're doing today for these instrumentations that have internal channels that we can't see. I have got to get a borescope. On the other side, though, I want to challenge all these borescope companies out there to take a look at your price point, because, hey,
yes,
I know it's expensive to make these things. They're digital, and I get it, you know. But also, guys, give us a break, right? Like, the VCR was super expensive when it first came out, and now I can't even find a VCR. Like, I tried to find one the other day. Like, they don't sell them on Amazon. I had to go to, like, Goodwill to find them. And it's just the influx of technology. There's no reason that these price points have to be this high, like 300% markup on borescopes, to outprice all these facilities who could get a budget of, you know, $3,000, $4,000. Yeah. But no, like, they're like triple that sometimes. And so it's going to take all parties involved to say, we care enough about the patient to meet in the middle, affordable borescopes in departments that are able to justify that in their budget.
Yeah, and Hank, I'm glad you, on the little graphic, I'm glad you put my personal pet peeve instrument, the one that I hate more than anything on the planet, and it is the arthroscopic shaver. It is one of the worst designed instruments. And what really drives me up the wall is it is one of the rare cases where we have a smoking gun peer review journal infection outbreak documented specific to reprocessing errors related to a single instrument, and that instrument is arthroscopic shaver. This is well known. You can go out there. This was documented. Like I said, in a peer-reviewed journal where 14 patients came down with an infection of Pseudomonas aeruginosa, and it was eventually tied back to failures in reprocessing these arthroscopic shavers. And what's crazy is that this, I believe if I remember correctly, that report came out in 2009. And the design of the shaver handle has not changed. It is the exact same design that we're still using. And the only thing that came out of that was the FDA made an announcement that said that, listen, you really should have some means of visually inspecting the internal channel of the shaver. Wow. Okay. So we've got a peer-reviewed journal, documented evidence of it spreading infection. And the FDA actually piped up and said, you need to inspect these with an internal microscope. And guess what? We still haven't caught on.
So here's I'll just give you some anecdotal feedback from being on the manufacturing side, right? So what should happen is that the manufacturer, and again, I don't know who the manufacturer is in this case. I'm just speaking from the perspective of being on the manufacturing side and have actually developed manufacturing or medical devices, is that they should have instructed facilities that in order to use that particular shaver, they had to visually inspect via a borescope to then ensure that there was no debris or bioburden in their apparatus, particularly if they weren't going to change the design of it, right? The other caveat to that is instrument manufacturers or medical device manufacturers are not supposed to mitigate risk via their IFU. That is something that the FDA, at least at the time that I was getting medical devices passed through the FDA, that was a mandate at that time. I don't know if that's the case now. I think it is, but I'm far removed from that now, managing a sterile processing department. So I can't definitively say that that's the case now. Now, if you're a manufacturer, what you would do with that feedback is you would say, okay, can we redesign the product so that it reduces risk? That is the ultimate goal. Now, are they getting the adequate feedback from the end user? That's a question. I don't know that. But as a manufacturer, you also internally to the organization, you need to constantly be in a refinement mode and to constantly try to make your device better and safer for the patients who are using your device. The only way you get to that is what we call a product feedback loop, and that is the end user giving feedback to the manufacturer and the manufacturer making modifications based on that feedback. On rare occasions when there's a adverse event and a patient has either gotten an infection or a death from that event, that goes directly to the FDA. But what happens, this is my question, what happens to those underlying events that necessarily don't get back to the manufacturer, so they don't know? And I think this is what happened in this case with the shavers. And what happens when there's no death associated with it, doesn't get back to the FDA? It's almost like a void. And I don't know the answer to this other than educate the end user on how to report and where to report, because some things don't necessarily need to go to the FDA. They need to go to the manufacturer. So they then can make the modification. And in this case, I think that was, this would be a catalyst to then say, hey, we need a redesign, because we need to make or design brushes or design cleaning mechanisms or protocols so that the shavers can be cleaned appropriately. Now, how futuristic would this be? I know I got an issue with my shaver, but if you buy my shaver, I'm giving you a fluoroscope. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Well, I think that's getting into something too, is should we be relying as a hospital or even as a sterile processing department solely on the regulatory strong arm to say, you have to do this before we decide of our own common sense, it's a good idea to do this. And that's kind of what's going back is like, yeah, we've got on these arthroscopic shaving handles, you know, it's clear evidence, like Mike said, it's been documented, it's peer reviewed. We know that this is a risk, but in another sense, if we're honest with ourselves, we all know anything that we can't see is a risk, you know, regardless of if there's any outcome or any documentation there. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, Sean, is like, are there proactive steps that companies can take themselves to say, hey, we understand as a manufacturer that in order to use this device appropriately, you're going to need X. And even if they don't sell it, heck, like, at least recommend it as a part of the sales cycle on your quote. Say, hey, we don't sell this, but FYI, you need this. Like, how much further down the field would we go if that's already on that quote to begin with, right?
Yeah, and these companies have plans where they give rebates, right? And those rebates could be used towards buying certain pieces of equipment like this. I know this because I've interacted with various companies and I've purchased certain things via these rebates. So if your volume is to where it needs to be and you meet those particular protocols, I think that the manufacturer can be a little more responsible for providing those things being used. Because granted, there's a delicate balance between designing a device for patient care and then designing a device that meets reprocessing standards. And sometimes the envelope is pushed to design for patient care, but necessarily isn't designed for reprocessing. And so as sterile processing professionals, we got to understand where that gray area is and then pitch to the administrators and or the department and or the end user or the outsourced reprocessor to make sure we have the means to fill that gap, right? And we're dealing with a lot of, there's a non-new technology coming on the market. And I can't tell you. So there are 3D printing devices now, right? With different textures and different sizes and different mated devices. And, you you 3D print something with different textures on it, how hard is that to clean? We in sterile processing, we look at pitting, right? Well, in orthopedics, when you're talking about an implant, a hip implant, knee implant, they're actually 3D printing devices with different textures to maximize osteoinduction and osteoconduction, right?
Yeah.
Well, that has nothing to do with sterile processing. Like, you're not going to reprocess that, right?
Right.
But if it's in a loaner pan, yes, we are. And, in fact, you can't reprocess. That, those are crevices that bioburden and debris can fill in and that we can't clean it. So, moving forward, I think there's, if I had to summarize the conversation, there's end-user feedback, and I think the FDA really needs to focus on surveying sterile processing professionals, like the ones that are on the ground floor, say, okay, what are your experiences? What are you feeling? What is giving you headaches at night? What keeps you up at night, right? And then transfer that into going to the medical device manufacturers to say, this is what our end users are experiencing. That's how I think the FDA could be actually more proactive.
Yeah, and I'm gonna chime in because I'm gonna drop a little bit of a bomb that I actually had a conversation with the research and development team of one of these manufacturers, and I just simply said, you know, I had a couple of ideas for how they could change the design of the device to make it more cleanable, and brought up, you know, the issue of the, you know, the journals and that's the journal infections, that sort of thing. I brought all that up, and they said, this is their answer, that they actually have a prototype on hand right now. This was several years ago, by the way. They had a prototype on hand that would address all of those issues. But what they ran into was that they, like most shaver manufacturers, make zero money on the shaver itself. In fact, most of the time they give the shaver away for free to hospitals because it's only compatible with one, you know, brand of burr. And so the idea is that if you buy the disposables, you get the reprocessable portion for free. And that's the case with many products in the medical device world. And so they said, consequently, their administration would not green light the production of this new shaver design because they knew that they would have to give them all away to all their customer hospitals. And so there was a price tag of, I think they said a little over $2 million that it was just going to cost the company just to essentially give these things all away. And there would be no extra revenue associated with that release of a new product. Consequently, they're not releasing it. They've got it. They're just not going to release it.
Okay. So two things I heard. Revenue. And then I heard issues with the device. So how, if I'm a medical device manufacturer and I say, okay, I don't want to do the redesign and I don't want to spend that much money, but what if I spent the money or a fraction of that money and I said, for every device that I sell you a shaver, knowing that the burr and the burrs that are used are reoccurring revenue for the company, I give you a borescope. And most borescopes are like, you can $1,500. You can get a borescope, no problem, right? That's one borescope that inspects all the shavers that go through there. And then you then edit your IFU to say, you must inspect our device, our shaver, with a borescope. I've done two things. I've mitigated the risk of the manufacturer. And then two, I've given the hospital or the end user a borescope to be able to effectively inspect that device. And if they don't inspect it, that's on the hospital, not on me as a manufacturer. Just saying.
Sure. But I think a lot of the manufacturers are sitting out there saying, listen, if they don't do anything, it's still not on me. I mean, I think essentially what you're asking for is the manufacturer to have a sense of corporate social responsibility. And the reality is that there are a number that don't have that, at least in specific to to this particular issue that it's just not there. Now, that doesn't mean that some enterprising administrator might hear this and say, you know what, that's a good idea. We should do that. We just haven't thought about it. And if that's the case, I applaud that.
No, I agree with you 100%, but I think there's a disconnect between the manufacturer and the end user. That is actually the root cause. And this is when I went to Dublin and I said to manufacturers, I said, hey, why not incorporate end users to be able to draft your IFU? Now, they don't have to draft it 100%, but they need to incorporate input into how you draft your IFU. And it was a novel idea, but it makes sense, you know, for me as an end user to say, okay, here's your device, here's your IFU, let an end user read it, interpret it, then process it based on the IFU, and then give you feedback. That currently does not exist in our ecosystem within medical device manufacturing. Doesn't.
Yeah, you're talking about market research, essentially, but you're including in the market the reprocessing portion.
Correct. And it doesn't happen on a scale where we need it for sterile processing professionals. That's why you get those booklets that are like 50 pages, 10 different languages, at 10 fonts, and you look at it and you're like, I can't interpret that. You go to IKEA right now. Exact thing you're going to do. You're going to go to IKEA. You're going to purchase the shelf or the desk that you want. You'll bring it home. You unbox it, and you'll try to put it together yourself before you even look at the IFU. Then you look at the IFU, and you go, well, wait a minute. I'm confused. That's what sterile processing faces right now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely right. That disconnect exists. Obviously we want every manufacturer who hears this broadcast, you need to incorporate a market research portion of the reprocessing part into your design. I mean, it has to be part of it if we're going to prevent things like the shaver from continuing to be the problem that it is. Anything else before we wrap, guys? Our 1 hour show is pushing an hour and a half at this point.
I think what three of us can talk for hours.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
Yeah, no, Mike, I just want to add, you know, it's been a great time, obviously, connecting with Sean again on the show. And I love doing these live broadcasts in particular because it really brings a flavor again of collaboration to this industry and bring subject matter experts like Sean on the show to really dive in and not just talk about it, you know, but really try to provide insight and tools and equip folks. And even if it's just have the courage, you know, to go back tomorrow morning and say, I need a borescope if you want me to continue to support these types of devices. You know, like we want folks to really get equipped and find value out of everything that we do through Beyond Clean. If it's a live broadcast, if it's a podcast, if it's the articles, our goal is to give you tools to make your patients safer, to really fight dirty every day. And I mean, this has been a great example of it tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me say, I mean, this is a Beyond Clean production, and consequently, I will tell you that anybody interested in doing market research and you want to talk to the end users, we can provide that service for you 100%. So please feel free to reach out if you're hearing this and you're saying, man, that is a good idea. We should do that. We can get that market data for you. We can do that research for you. Before we sign off, I want to give Sean, number one, just say thank you for coming on the show. Your input, as always, has been incredibly enlightening.
Well, I just want to first thank you guys. And related to Beyond Clean, and I'm not big on endorsements or things like that, making it cheesy or anything like that, but I will say that you guys definitely, as founders of Beyond Clean, have the passion associated with reforming and totally transforming this industry and making it better for not just the people that work in this industry, but also the patients. Because at the end of the day, it's about that. And you guys have stepped up, and you know, I can't give you credit enough for centralizing the effort associated with sterile processing, because before that it was decentralized, and you guys have basically centralized that into a platform where people can go to and then talk the dirty truth. If I had to just, you know, say what it is, and we're comrades, we stick together, and I applaud you guys, man. So anytime, you know, you guys, regardless of this podcast or any other thing that we do, you know, I will support you 100%.
Well, thank you, Sean. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for all your kind words. Thank you to all our listeners, both live listeners and those who are listening to the recording. This has been Beyond the Headlines with Beyond Clean with special guest Sean Flynn. Thank you. Have a good night.